Hello and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. My name is Tracy Morgan, your host, and today we're very happy to have with us Galit Atlas. We'll be talking with her about her most recent publication, a book from Routledge, The Enigma of Desire, Sex, Longing, and Belonging in Psychoanalysis. Welcome, Galit. Hello.
Hello.
It's really a delight to have you on the show. And I have to, I guess, journalistically, full disclosure, I see that I'm thanked in this book. And in the acknowledgments, I was like, oh. So, you know, if I was like really a hardcore journalist, I guess I would not be, in the New York Times.
Don't be so sure.
Exactly. So I thought, like, well, let me just tell everyone, yes, we know each other. Yes, we're friends. And I'm excited to talk to you about the book. I've been reading your articles, over the years and getting familiar with, how you're thinking and how you're working. The first question that we tend to ask in New Books in Psychoanalysis is, what prompted you? What drove you? However you want to put it. What generated your desire to write this particular book? So can we begin there?
Oh, absolutely. And it's a good question, but I'm not sure I have only one answer for that. I think there is something. First of all, writing was always part of my life. And so I didn't feel, there was no specific desire to write a book. The book was written kind of by itself. And at the end, I took everything that I wrote and I made it to a book. Mm-hmm. And so there was something about, you probably know about my life. Mm-hmm. That writing a book is not so easy.
Right.
Because I have a hectic life. So there is something about this book that is written in the car and while I'm cooking. And there is a lot of, I can block myself and just write. And the funny thing, I think there are, in retrospect, I found that there are a lot of references to cooking and the kitchen. And I only knew that when I kind of went over it and wrote the introduction and I added it to the introduction, because it was interesting to see that I didn't know that I was cooking in the book. And there are a lot of spices that leaked into the writing.
Yeah, well, that's really clear. I mean, actually, I'm interested in terms of your writing process, because I know you do have a very busy life. You have, you have three kids, you have a love life, mm-hmm. you have, you're teaching, you're working with patients. And did you dictate to yourself? I mean, were you at the computer? Were you speaking into your, whatever mm-hmm. that thing is on the iPhone? How did you manage to put this book together while you were in the middle of so many other things?
Yeah, both. First of all, I don't believe in inspiration, I have to say. I believe in working. And so I had hours that I blocked for writing. And I still do. I have once a week that I write for a few hours. And, I have this famous writer who Israeli writer, Albert Yehoshua, who said, when I write, it's like going to the grocery shop. It's like owning a grocery shop. You open it every minute, every morning. Sometimes people come, sometimes they don't come. Mm-hmm. But it's work. Right. And so that's part of it. The other part is that I always have a notebook with me. And wherever I go, while I'm in the process of writing something, I'm always writing when I, when I'm on the way. I don't always look when I cross the street, when I am, doing other things, I also have thoughts and process my writing.
So you basically, what you're saying, I think, is that you have access, that you're the kind of person who has access to sort of multiple registers within herself frequently and can sort of be functioning pragmatically and enigmatically.
Exactly. That's where I led you to the enigmatic and pragmatic.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. I mean, so the book covers a lot of a lot of ground. It covers, you know, thinking about motherhood, thinking about sexuality, thinking about, I think, listening, how the analyst works when thinking about the pragmatic and the enigmatic. And so we have these binaries, conscious, unconscious, internal, external, masculine, feminine, you know, et cetera. How would you describe what the addition of pragmatic, enigmatic, what does this bring to the psycho, these concepts as you're working with them, what do they bring to the psychoanalytic encounter?
You know, I think first of all, the main paper chapter that started as a paper that I introduced these ideas where it is the Enigma of Desire. And when I wrote that chapter, it was clear that I'm dealing with the split between psychoanalysis and research, even, you know, and you can see that in the book, there is a lot of, there are a lot of references to infant research, and yep. Beatrice Beebe is one of my mothers, like Jessica Benjamin and Adrienne Harris, and I opened the book with the confession that my first mother was a Kleinian.
That's clear. You can feel, I feel her throughout the book. Yes.
Yeah, I don't know. Some people think that I say it that way because it's embarrassing, but it's not. Yeah. I think that there is something about trying to integrate some ideas that come from research and very traditional psychoanalysis that are, by definition, I think, contradicting, you know, is a contradiction. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the feedback that I got on the first draft of The Enigma of Desire, the chapter, was, you're confusing languages. So I felt that there was something that was necessary, especially, and here I think the enigmatic and the pragmatic are not necessarily related to conscious and unconscious. Mm-hmm. They're both and, but they're not, it's not that the enigmatic is unconscious and the pragmatic is conscious. It is more about seen and unseen, the logical, the practical, the thing that we can see and grasp versus the what is happening under the surface, the thing that has no words, that we can never fully define, that which is hard to define and more puzzling, I would say, hard to observe, which is definitely not research, right? Because in the research, we basically research what we see and can measure. And so that was missing for me, you know, that back and forth between what we can actually see and measure and what we cannot, can never measure, right? And I'm thinking it goes back to some early arguments. And I'm thinking about, for example, Andre Green's paper where that he wrote for Freud's birthday, yep. That is asking about sexuality, anything to do with psychoanalysis, right? The question of, and in that paper, he attacks the whole idea of infant observation, mm-hmm. saying that in fact what we observe is a very small part of the infant's life, because most of the time infants are sleeping, right? So they're not interacting. Uh-huh. And when in infant observation, what you measure is the little interaction that they have, and what about the rest of the time, right? So there is also that voice, right? And I'm trying to find a way way to integrate the two, because for me that was missing.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just realized I believe that I have read something that you wrote, and it might have been a dissertation, correct? This is you, right? It was a dissertation about, or maybe it was your final paper in your training, but about children who are sexually abused.
Susceptibility to sexual abuse, yeah.
It's funny. Like, I hadn't, as you're talking now, I was like, my God, you've been working this terrain for quite a while. Would you talk a little, it's not really in the book, but I think it's implicit in the book. Could you say a little bit about that dissertation and what your question was? Because it's about research, but it's a very creative use of of research that it's truly a precursor to what you have written here, I think.
It's really funny you're bringing this because I almost forgot about it. And only in the last year, Lou Aaron and I are writing a new book that is called Dramatic Dialogues, Contemporary Clinical Practice. And the idea is really about the dramatization and drama in sessions. It's a very clinical book. Mm-hmm. And when we start writing this, I suddenly said, hey, you know, I did something like that many, many years ago. And then I went to my dissertation for the first time after, like, I think it was many years ago, after I don't know how long. And I read it again, and I'm using some things from that dissertation that I've actually never used before for our book. The dissertation was a combination of psychoanalysis and drama therapy and related to, you know, I started as a child therapist, mm-hmm. so related to my work with children. But also there is a lot of enigma in this research. You know, one interesting story, first of all, was that I decided at some point to use for my research the fairy tale Red Riding Hood. Mm-hmm. And I thought that part of my idea was that through playing with kids the fairy tale, you could assess something about their susceptibility to sexual abuse. A lot of the archetypes in these, in fairy tales in general, but I narrowed it to this, but I found it in many fairy tales, right. About being alone in the woods, about being hungry.
Yep.
And so I start playing with kids. At that moment, almost every child I treated that time suddenly asked me to play Red Riding Hood. And so that was really interesting. And part of what I found is that, Red Riding Hood is walking in the woods with a basket full with food, and most kids are eating the food on their way to the grandmother.
Right.
And, things like that. And I developed an assessment tool that could really, think about what makes kids more susceptible to getting attached to strangers and to going with and to not reporting abuse and, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was my research from a long time ago.
Yeah, I mean, it fascinated me. I think the first time I saw you present, and I think you maybe presented, I don't know which one of the chapters or a version, you were with Jessica Benjamin at NPAP, and it was on, which two men, I forget which two men you describe here, but, and I was like, wow, this woman is really interesting. And I Googled you and I found this dissertation and I began to go through it. And I was like, this is so creative. I love it. You know, I was like, wow, Little Red Riding Hood. And as a way of understanding which of these children was susceptible, which children. And then I think to myself, what were the enigmatic messages, mm-hmm. right, that different children, received, right, about mm-hmm. themselves, about, you know, from the mother's unconscious.
Yeah. And you know something? I think that there are a lot of problems with research also, right? Even with my research, because life is bigger than research.
Right. I mean, I think that what I like about the book is, you know, on the one hand, you're talking about, I think what captured my attention is this attempt to describe, what's enigmatic. Mm-hmm. There are moments in the book where you say, my attempt to put words to the enigmatic undermines what's enigmatic, right? At some level, like it's not, it transforms it from, from enigmatic to, I don't, maybe we would say to pragmatic.
To pragmatic, yeah.
Yeah.
Because words are always necessarily pragmatic.
Yeah.
I mean, at least in the narrow frame that I put it, it's the minute you talk, you narrow your experience. So there is something about the enigmatic that almost contradicts words.
Sure. No, absolutely. I mean,
and therapy, right?
Yeah.
In that sense.
Yeah. So what do you, I sense that there's a real strong turn in the last couple of years to the work of LaPlanche here stateside, uh-huh. you know, in this country. And would, Would you care to say something about that? Like, any thoughts about, you know, the strong embrace of LaPlanche currently in American psychoanalysis? Is like a need being met? Like, what would you say is going on in the field?
Wow, that's a good question.
Like, you know, like Avi's work. I mean, you know, there's.
I know, but you know, maybe a lot. I'll tell you. I'm not sure that I have the answer for that because it is enigmatic. But I think maybe first of all, a lot of the people that bring it are not Americans, including me and Avi. I grew up analytically in much more of a European culture. Right. Even my sessions were used to be 50 minutes and not back to back. Not anymore, by the way.
Right.
But I think there is something more, you know, European, French. In general, I think Lacan became bigger in America, in New York especially, I think, lately. Yep. So I really wonder about that. And I'm happy about that because it's the whole conversation, I think. In my book, I'm talking about conversations between East and West, but I'm thinking even in psychoanalysis, right, between America and Europe, the dark side. In some ways I come from more the light side and the positive side in the American culture. It's talking about sex and sexuality, you know, there is a question, you know, cultural question here. And you know, you mentioned Jessica Benjamin, which was, as I mentioned, one of my mothers, my mentors. Right. And she and I, the third chapter that is called Excited Idiot.
Yes, that's right.
It's based on a chapter that Jessica and I wrote together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the one that you heard us presenting together also. Too muchness of excitement. Mm-hmm. And this chapter was translated to Spanish. And Jessica it was published in the International Journal for Psychoanalysis, and they translated it to Spanish, so that they had a Spanish edition. And at some point, they invited Jessica and I to present in some kind of an online discussion, online colloquium that is called something like debate, which basically, even the name, is inviting people to argue. So it's not as nice as the Arab colloquium that everybody's mostly agreeing with each other. I mean, it is pretty hot there.
Yeah.
And Jessica and I do not know a word in Spanish. And we were invited to this discussion and trying to figure out what they're saying through Google Translate. And at some point,
and the enigmatic, yeah.
Exactly. And at some point we asked Andrea, one of my students who is Chilean originally, to help us understand what's going on. And I think it's related to what you're saying. There was a lot of confusion of tongues and a lot of really interesting debate about, especially about what I define as the pragmatic. The question if the pragmatic even belongs to psychoanalysis or not, right? And people there said, why affect regulation is even psychoanalysis? It's not about the unconscious. Mm-hmm. It's not about conflicts. It's not about, and very traditional voices that argued, and it was a wonderful discussion, I have to say. We felt very, in some ways, understood, although I think a lot of people disagreed with us or felt like we are, you know, some American traditions that some of them did not even know what, you know, things that are obvious to us here in New York, you know, the notion of intersubjectivity, and asked us to explain what intersubjectivity means. You know, it was pretty amazing to see, to hear that dialogue.
Well, you know, what's funny is as you're speaking, I thought, my God, how come I didn't think of William James and pragmatism? I mean, the way in which you're using your, you know, sort of the enigmatic is embedded in the pragmatic, and the pragmatic is also embedded in the enigmatic. But it is, you know, of course, American pragmatism, Richard Rorty. I mean, like, there's such a tradition, and yet your use of the word, you know, pragmatic doesn't smack of any of that to me. So that's, That's kind of
that's great.
Yeah, so it's surprising. I want to ask you a question, actually. I mean, I know you've worked a lot with Jessica Benjamin, and you know, been very influenced by her work, and yet, in this book, clearly, you've given motherhood a lot of thought, and in fact, you know, maybe, you know, sort of the frame of the book at some level is a rethinking of the impact of motherhood on both the mother and the infant and the later, you know, the adult, who comes, who you know, crosses, the threshold into our consulting rooms. So I sense that you're trying to redress, to, you know, sort of take by the hand a theoretical, sort of missing piece in the field of psychoanalysis and thinking about motherhood. But how would you say your thinking, I mean, Jessica Benjamin is known for, you know, saying that the mother has, the mother is a subject. The child needs the mother to be a subject, to have subjectivity. Her subjectivity is important. But you go somewhere else. How would you describe the ways in which your work is different from Jessica's thinking about the impact of the mother on...
You know, I'll start with saying that I'm not sure it is completely different, because it definitely starts there.
Yeah.
In some ways, I feel that working with Jessica personally, there is some... Her influence on me was huge, especially her thinking about motherhood. While I was working with her, I became a mother. Right? I think I was... All right. Maybe I start working with her 10 years ago, when right after I had my twins, or but motherhood was very much part of our conversation. My own body, my children's body, and you know, her as a mother, birth. A lot of my patients, you can see in the book, are giving birth.
Yes.
Being pregnant,
right?
There is a lot of there is almost too muchness of mother and mother's body, and you know, I'm thinking about Kristeva's, you know, to the objection, right? Of it's just too much. It's too much breast milk, and it's too much. And sometimes people say, "Where's the father?" Like, help, call the father, please. It's too much, you know. And you know, somebody told me that they thought that there is something about the mother in the book, that it's almost like every chapter is, let's talk about sex and my mother. And let's talk about the enigmatic and my mother.
And my mother, right.
My mother. And then, of course, the reference to Dali and my mother, my mother, my mother.
No, my
mother. But there is some reparation there, I think.
I want the audience to know about the painting, Dali's painting, The Enigma of Desire, or My Mother, My Mother, My Mother. It's from 1929, and it's like, God, you know.
Yes, yes. And so I open, you know, in the introduction, I say something about it, because only after I decided to, again, a lot of uncanny things, when I decided that this is going to be the name of the book, I Googled the name to see if anybody else wrote a book, you know, if this book already exists. And then I found, I didn't know about that Dali painting, and then I found it, and I was kind of shocked when I saw that the subtitle was My Mother, My Mother, My Mother.
Right.
And I thought, yes, that's it. This is the, you know, this is the book. Yeah. So that's that, a lot about the mother, and sexuality and the mother in some ways is maybe a correction to, first of all, to conversations about fathers and sons that were so part of the mainstream.
Right.
And Oedipal and the father and the son were the center of our thinking. And also about sexuality, that
right.
I feel like, all right, we talk about sex, but, you know, my mother.
Right. And you're talking about sexuality. I mean, I read this book as perhaps filling in a gap in the relational psychoanalytic literature as regards sexuality and the body. And I wanted to ask if you saw yourself as addressing sort of a caesura or a blind spot within that school of thought.
Not consciously. I didn't say, okay, I'm going to fill that gap. No. I went mostly after my own longings, you know, and what I felt. And a lot, this is a very clinical book. So I felt like a lot of where I come from is from the couch, right? From my office, from my very profound connection with my patients, you know. So a lot of the people that I wrote about read what I wrote about them, commented on it. You know, there is something about the passion and the love that exists in the womb, which is also related to the mother and the baby, right? About the dyad and the desire. And so consciously I didn't say, let me fill that gap, but I felt that something was missing for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what really stands out is the way in which the body, your body as an analyst, your sort of use of your own physical experience. You have an incredible story, clinical story about a patient reacting to your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
In which you, and then you experience your breath as constricted and then you attempt to work with what's happening that I'm, you know, my breath is being constricted while I'm with this patient. Talk about the enigmatic message.
Yeah.
What's taking place there? Yeah. And it's a beautiful clinical tale, and I love. I mean, I'm not going to give the story away. You have to buy the book, but I'm not going to give you the ending.
No,
it's happy. It's a happy ending.
No spoilers.
But it's. I mean, it's really extraordinary the way in which, you know, the body and sort of the, you know, feelings that are hard to find words for. Now you don't think in terms of pre-Oedipal and Oedipal so much, is my sense. Is that correct? You're sort of...
Yes.
Yeah.
I actually challenge it mostly because I think, you know, traditionally the pre-Oedipal was considered more primitive, mm-hmm. and less developed. And the way that I argue in especially, you know, in the book, is that I don't see these two things as in a hierarchy, that one is more developed than the other. Because I think the mother and baby relationship is so rich and complex,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? And more enigmatic. It's true. It's not. It's less about words.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's also. I mean, I got the sense that it's, you know, sort of both and. There's a lot of both and in the book. Both at once. Sort of in a Lowell Waldian sense, you know, where you really get, you know, like nothing is ever, you know. Nothing is ever lost, and it's both pre-Oedipal and Oedipal elements, perhaps, if you want to put it that way, that interests you.
And you know, I want to say one more thing about that because of what you said before about the body. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about it a lot these days, and I think probably my next writing will be about that, because there is something about the enigmatic and the pragmatic that for me emphasizes the need for both. And you know, there is something that we idealize about the body. There is a lot of writings about the body, but the truth is that as kids, the body is pretty disgusting, right? We don't want it. Too much body is not attractive.
Right.
So even when we deal with the body, we deal with it in some idealized way, even in psychoanalysis, you know, mm-hmm. we, you know, think about poetry, think about, you know, art. There is something about making it beautiful. Yeah. And in fact, there is a lot of things that it smells bad sometimes, it looks bad sometimes. When you die, there is only body. So there is something about the balance. It can't be. We cannot have too much body,
mm-hmm.
in life in general, right.
right?
We have to find that balance between mind and body, between the pragmatic and the enigmatic.
Well, you're also very drawn, and this was notable to me. I did not interview Gohar Homanya. I'm so bad. Mm-hmm, Homayan Pour. Yeah,
and
doing psychoanalysis in Tehran, but I did read the book, and I was struck. You're both, you know, women who would identify as Persian. I is that correct? If I were to say that,
my dad is from Iran.
So, and she really, you know, her book is sort of a, you know, a an homage, I mean, to the work of Kristeva. And I sense you're very drawn to Kristeva. Mm-hmm. And so at the risk of sort of being an essentialist here, I wanted to ask.
Many times of being an essentialist. Yeah.
So we'll be essentialists together. I mean, do you think that there's something, and of course she wrote on Chinese women, right? So here we go. I mean, do you think that there's something in Kristeva's work that captures a certain something about contemporary Eastern femininity or womanhood that I was so struck by both yourself and Gohar being,
I think you're picking up on something real, you know, and I'll tell you what I think it is. Not too long ago, a student came to me from who was writing her dissertation, and she came to me to be one of her advisors. And she is an Iranian woman, and her dissertation was on the topic of women in Iran. And we talked about it, and she came to me after she read my chapter, Sex in the Kitchen, which is about Iran. And I have to say, unlike Gohar, I didn't live in Tehran, only in my fantasies and dreams. So I can only imagine. Uh-huh. And there is a piece of, you know, there is a piece of idealization in my writing about the East. I have to admit, even when I read it, I notice idealization, you know, something about that thing, you know, a little bit, you know, but also because it is, this is where my grandmother that I really loved came from. Mm-hmm. And I think there is something that you're picking up on, because mothers are the center of the way I grew up and my family grew up. And, and that woman who wrote about women in Tehran confirmed that to me. There is something about mothers that are in some ways the head of the family.
Yeah.
And in ways that I'm not sure is so visible. I think it's more enigmatic, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's why she decided to write this dissertation, actually, I think, because it wasn't so clear that it looks like more on the surface that men are the dominant people. But I think there was another layer, right? As always.
Yeah.
It was not only men. It's also something about the maternal. Mm-hmm. And there is also something about maternal and boundaries. Mm-hmm. And in Sex in the Kitchen, I'm talking about, related to Kristeva, about the boundaries of the body. I give some examples from literature, Persian literature, where they talk about how the mother penetrates her children's body, and the children's body belong to her, right? And think about it. Our children's body belong to us when they are born, right? We're allowed to pick their nose, to wipe their butt, you know, and there is one point in their life when they say, "Mom, leave me alone, you know, yucky. You know, why are you licking me to clean my face?"
Right.
Because and that's the point, you know, when we start celebrating their birthday as belong to them and not, "Hey, that's the day I gave birth," you know, which, you know, I think in the first, second birthdays of my children, I used to celebrate, like, I actually went, this time I went to the labor in a room and, you know, it's about me. So at some point, their body belongs to them and their birthdays belong to them and it's about them.
Right.
And I think there is something about that related to Kristeva's ideas and related to the, you know, to everything I bring, the cultural piece, like especially from Iran, that about the mother penetrating, there is a story about the mother penetrating her daughter's vagina, like sticking her fingers to see if the daughter had her period or not.
Right.
And that's from Dori Toubinian's book. There is something about the boundaries between a mother and and the child that is less rigid, or you could say less boundaried.
Well, you know, when you think about Kristeva and all the abject, and you write a lot about fluids, and Kristeva writes about fluids, and initially the child is, you know, just a certain kind of fluid. A fluid that eventually walks around, you know, and and you have to deal with all their fluids. Whose fluids are they anyway?
I love that. Whose fluids are they anyway?
But let's think, okay, you do something else really, terrific. And I think, a lot more, I think that a lot more, may be written about this, by you and by others who will take off, from your thinking. This book is about autoeroticism. Wouldn't you say?
Totally.
At some level, I had the idea that to have an analysis with Galit Atlas, one would, on completion of the analysis, many things may have, you know, come to the surface and been worked through, but your analysis have a sense of an interest and a possession of something autoerotic that they leave with. That is really the strong idea I had on.
Wow.
Yeah. So can you talk about, you also have different ideas about East and West, the difference between desire and sexuality, that it's a, you know, like an interesting, basket of things around autoeroticism. Can you say more about your thoughts about it?
Yeah. First of all, I want to say writing a book is an autoerotic experience.
Indeed.
Absolutely. It's really, there is something very sensual about it. You know what I do sometimes, almost all the times, to tell you the truth, to make sure that I like what I write, I read it to myself loud.
Oh yeah.
And when I read it, then I know, you know, if it's funny, I laugh. You think it's a little bit like this psychotic, experience that somebody's reading something to themselves and I laugh and I say, oh, this is dumb. And I say, oh, no, this is not the right tone. It has to be this. I listen to the music. It's all like having sex with yourself.
Totally.
So that's where I start.
That's the kind of writer I am too. I have to read it aloud and walk around the house and like hear it. And that, you know, it is very autoerotic. It's very exciting, and you're exciting yourself, you know.
I think that's a goal, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting, you know. I'm thinking about, you were mentioning the difference between desire and sexuality, and I'm thinking about the difference between the ability to act sexually, to have a sexual act, to have sex.
Right.
The permission to have sex. Yep. And the permission to desire. And those are two things that I differentiate in the book. Yep. These are not the same. Yep. And I talk about East and West as places that generally, again, generalizing, there is, I think in our culture, there is more permission to act sexually. You see young kids act sexually. They're not really in touch with their body, but it's an act. Mm-hmm. It's pragmatic.
Right.
And between the zone, you know, the realm of desire, where it's not always about the other. Judith Butler writes about that. Lacan writes about that, right? It's not always only, you know, it's not only about the other. It's also about us and about our own body and our own ability to desire. And so I try to differentiate the two. And I actually think that my reference to the East is not because I think it's, you know, it's not part of my idealization. I think sometimes it's the practical thing that there is no permission to act sexually as much. And there is a lot more separation between men and women, or between, you know, so there is something much more, not only autoerotic, also homoerotic, right? And so I'm trying to really talk about those, you know, all of those as in one, you know, as one thing.
Well, what's also coming to mind when I think about your writing on autoeroticism, it's interesting given that, you know, you're more part of, or, you know, known to be more part of a relational frame, and yet, You're suggesting something else. It really reminds me, of course, you know, like of Freud. Like, what does the baby want? The baby wants relief from, you know, it's an interesting privileging of a relationship with the self rather than, you know, something interpersonal. It's a very, it's an intrapersonal privileging, in your work that, although it to some degree it is derived from a relationship, you emphasize something very intra as opposed to inter.
Mm-mm, I agree with you. I think it's really some kind of integration in my mind. You know, one of my study groups called our study group relational Kleinians. You know, I don't know that there is such a thing, but that's, for me, that's the integration. And a lot of my thinking is about the capacity to love, the capacity to desire, which is something that is not only, you know, classically we're thinking sometimes about how much the child needs to be loved and how much we need to be loved by the other, what we need to get from the other.
Right.
And it's true that sometimes my thinking starts more from the other direction, right? About how, which are related, right? You can't separate mm-hmm. the two. But mm-hmm. how much, you know, what is it, what is the capacity to love or to experience desire? And what does it mean about the body, the relation to the body? What kind of tension you can tolerate or should tolerate in order to desire someone else? Right. And in what way it is related to pain? Mm-hmm. You know, of course, we're going back to Laplanche here.
Right. Right. Yeah. Right. What, I think it's the second to last chapter. I guess it's the last chapter of the book, which is really, it's interesting. It's, you're thinking about, ideas about the future,
mm-hmm.
About agency, working prospectively. We don't really, I don't read a lot about these ideas in psychoanalysis. Of course, we're sitting and listening to our patients and, you know, you can't help but to have like, you know, the idea about the patient in the future. But you're mm-hmm. trying, you and I guess you and Lou are, yeah, it yeah. seems that he's very present in that, in this chapter, on addressing the enigmatic future, I think it is, or I don't know.
Yes.
So what role does the enigmatic play in helping, or what role can it play in helping our patients to dream, I think you say, to dream the future?
I'll tell you a little bit about that. First of all, yes, this is a chapter that was originally written with Lou Aaron, and we published it in Dialogues, and it was the first chapter that for our next book. So this chapter, a version of it, not exactly that the way it is in my book, but a version of that and of those ideas is going to be included in Dramatic Dialogues, our book. Mm-hmm. And what we were trying to really think enigmatic and pragmatic, I have to say, combined, about the dreaming of our future, and we think about enactments and the function of enactments, not only the resolving the enactment, but actually the enactment itself as a way to rehearse for the future, as a way to really practice the ability to change and something that happens in the future, which is in some ways much more related to Bionian ideas than to Freudian ideas, right? With the understanding, the Bionian understanding, right, that the mind is really always striving to toward health and development, right? And our wish to develop and to the next step. So we were thinking really about how unconsciously, right, and enigmatically we are always practicing for the next step, including death, you know. Right. But in this chapter, we're not really talking about death yet. We are mostly talking about we're talking about separations mostly, how the mind practices, you know, and we give their, one of the clinical examples is really about a woman that leaves therapy, and in retrospect, that was an enactment that helped her to leave her husband.
Right, right.
To leave her husband. So that was and of course the other example, Sophie's case, is about dreaming her husband.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and it's a real story, you know, it's one of those things that happen, that the woman is, the patient that I was describing, this patient actually really insisted that I include this in my book, and she was like, everybody has to know about this story, because it was so uncanny, you know, that she was dreaming, she had a dream about a guy, and the next day she met that guy,
Right.
You know, he became her husband, the father of her children, after many, many years where she was looking for relationships and, you know.
Well, so, I mean, I'm a real believer, you know, in this thing that can happen in the consulting room where a patient starts to talk about something finally that they know that they really want and that they're really interested in, and they're talking about something that they've never spoken about before. And, you know, and then it's not uncommon that within the next like few weeks in one of the sessions, they're like, you wouldn't believe what happened, but I'm always like, okay, magic, right?
But there's exactly magic.
Yeah. It's like, but it is kind of like magic. It's like, okay, what is that? I mean, I'm just thinking of a patient who has a hard, finally says, I want a raise. And a lot of work has taken place around her feelings about money and this and that. She walks in after we have this, you know, several weeks of her talking about money and a raise and all these different feelings about it. She shows up at work and the boss gives her a really big gift and a raise. And she says, but I, and I had this like thought, like, how many times have I seen this in like 20 years as a clinician? I was like, and it, and of course, in my own life as an analysand, you know, I'm like, what is that? You know, how do we explain that to the insurance company, you know?
That you're practicing for the future also, you know? I'm practicing for the future, you know?
That's right. Treatment plan.
Practicing for the future. Yeah.
That actually, they would probably like, you know, not, they'll probably give you like another like 10 sessions for that. We're practicing for the future. Okay.
You can say we're rehearsing for the future.
Right. We're rehearsing for it almost sounds like cognitive behavioral therapy. We're rehearsing for the future. The book is interesting in that you get to this place and I'm thinking about young and the future and something prospective. And then I thought, okay, that the book's over and I turn the page and there's death.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the drama of it, first of all. I mean, it's like a two-page, you know, prologue, whatever it's called. I'm so bad with those things, but an epilogue. And I was wondering, tell me about the decision, because it didn't seem like it was tacked on. It made sense, but it had a dun-dun-dun-dun, you know. I don't know. I just wanted to ask, like, okay, and now...
It's really funny because when you said you turn the page and there is death.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, like my daughter said, duh. What else did you think you're going to find when you turn the page?
Well, the end of the book is death, you know, but there was death before the end of the book.
Of course. And because there is a lot of birth.
Yeah.
Right? And there is a lot of birth and a lot of, I'm going back to, as I said before, death, my mother. You know, there is again, you know, that link to the vagina. There is a lot of vagina in the book, and to my mother, and to the body. And think about what we said before about the body, and you know, and there is something that felt necessary. I have to say, it wrote itself.
Well, it's also, I mean, perhaps, you know, the part of what makes mothers so terrifying is they're in charge of life and death. You know, the decision to, I have a friend, who's also Israeli. I've got to get you this essay of hers. Her name is Michal Tzion. She's an analyst and she's writing also about Kristeva, but she's writing about like the mother's decision, like the decision to actually, you know, get pregnant. Like she's just, and it's really related in some way. I was like, oh, it's too bad you guys didn't meet or you should meet and write an essay together. But it's like the feelings that are aroused in like, you know, that the mother can just get, the woman can get pregnant, you know, and that this is a decision, not a decision, unconscious. It happens. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there's so much bound up in just that. Forget the actually having the baby, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you know, there is one chapter that we didn't mention, and that's the chapter Breaks in Unity.
Yes.
Which
I have a question about that. I'm glad you said that. Tell us about Breaks in Unity. Okay.
Breaks in Unity is an unusual chapter because it's a little different than the other chapters. It's not based on a real case. It's based on the movie before the three movies Before Midnight, Before Sunset, Before Sunrise. Yeah. You know, I watched the third movie, and the third movie was so sad to me. And that's where she became, you remember that?
Oh yeah.
She became a mother, and suddenly you see a broken woman.
Yeah.
And I suddenly recognize her, and I recognize her eyes, and I recognize her in each and every woman I know who gave birth. That feeling that there is something that broke.
Mm-hmm.
And it is not, and I'm not talking about trauma, and I'm not talking about anything that is, you know, something you cannot repair or, you know, anything pathological.
Right.
I'm talking more about something existential, I guess. And that's why I'm blamed of being an essentialist, because I feel like there is something existential about that crazy thing of getting a baby that grows inside your body and gets out.
Right.
You know, my 5-year-old, every morning she wakes up, she said, I'm going to adopt a child because nothing is going to get out of my belly.
Nothing like me is coming out of me.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Not going to happen. She said, not going to happen. I said, all right, you don't have to, you know.
Well, you have a quote, actually. I think this was my favorite chapter. I can't believe we didn't talk about it, because this chapter I thought was really, well, it's like kind of, it's, you know, there's something groundbreaking about what you're doing here for sure. And you write, breaks in unity, capital B, capital I, capital U, breaks in unity are a potential part of the female structure. And in that sense, a way to postulate this aspect of the woman's subjective position as a norm and not something to be viewed as exceptional, pathological, or unique.
Yeah.
I was like, okay, all right. Now you're like taking it on here, you know?
what do you think?
No, I mean, I think it's a really interesting, idea. Theoretically, it's like, okay, you know, it's so far, what is it? It struck me as so unique. You know, within psychoanalysis, the attempt to theorize the body, you know, with Rosemary Balsam, like all the, mm-hmm. I was like, no, this is real. This strikes me as real. Like this break in unity, around motherhood and birth. You know, as something that is unique, you're attempting to say something about what it is to live in a female body.
And by the way, there is such a thing as a female body.
Right.
I don't know if you know this, but you know, I feel like that's a way of thinking, you know, because there, when I said a norm, I mean that sometimes it feels like some people say, you know, there is the body and there is, you know, we have hands and then there is the woman. That's exceptional. You know, it's
right.
Like, it's phenomenal. But I feel like, you know, it's normal.
Right. 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 No, I think that this is a great theoretical kind of breakaway. I was like, whoa, this is exciting, you know, let's catch this wave. And this should be further. I mean, I think further explored and thought about, you know, so hats off to you for that. I was like, wow. Okay.
Thank you. You know, for this chapter is special for me, especially for two reasons. One, because really it didn't start with a real patient, but with a movie, which was unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow that chapter that did not start with the real patient, I get the most feedback as clinically helpful.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people contacted me and asked me if it's okay to give a patient, you know, to let a patient read this, to give the patient the book,
right.
Because there is something about women's experience around birth, mm-hmm. that there is no theory for us, you know,
we are
less lonely.
It's really true. And I felt there is something like very, sort of containing, or like writing it, you know, it was like writing something that was a wrong, so to speak, or like filling in a blank that I was like, well, how come that blank hasn't been filled in for so long? There it is. You know, there was just something about like a missing piece that this idea began to address. And, you know, I mean,
I think because mostly, and that is actually is continuing Jessica's thought about the mother as a subject, basically because mothers were objects. So the experience of birth is not, and originally most of the theory was written by men.
Right.
So the, that combination left mothers as tools, you know, objects. And I think there is, it's missing, and the theory there, and I think Rosemary Balsam is one of the women that actually really screams that in her papers, like, something is missing, guys, there is something missing about the maternal experiences.
Right. And also, the vagina, right? The vaginal, like, it's like, you know, I think I, the very first interview I did for New Books in Psychoanalysis was with a Dutch analyst, I think, and her name is Hendrika Freud. And in her book, she says, and if we don't teach girls about, more or less, she says straight out, if we don't teach them that they have vaginas, how will they ever know? More or less, like, it's,
I love that.
You know, I don't know that I completely agree with that, but I, but it's also, if there aren't words for something, then, you know, if it doesn't also, if it remains only enigmatic.
And I think, you know, when you say that, I'm thinking that they will know.
Yeah.
We all know at the end that we have vaginas, but sometimes we know is through men.
Right.
You know, they say, hey, vagina, you know, or through, you know, through the other. And again, I'm going back, I guess, into my autoerotic.
No, no, you don't, you do not want your female patients to discover only through the other their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's, it's very, very, it's really clear in your work. Listen, my dear, we have to stop.
Really?
Like, yes, because I don't know. It's like already, we're already 5 and almost 6 minutes over the, you know.
Yeah.
And what can I say? we're having fun, and this was really really fun. So just to the listening audience, there's going to be this is a, sort of I'm interviewing a number of Israelis, and so the next book up I'm trying to get to is Orna Ophir's book, which is on the treatment of psychosis, schizophrenia in America in the post-war period. So she's another Israeli analyst here, as is Galit, an Israeli analyst. And then there's another book, and I can't remember his name. This is terrible. Aner, blah, blah, blah. Anyway,
Aner Govrin.
Thank you so much. I knew you would know. Yeah. And Aner's book is up on deck. So this is like a few summers ago, I did like the Summer of Men and Masculinity. This is the Summer of Israeli Analysts, like, apparently. So that's where I will be headed to let my listeners know. And Galit, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tracy. I really enjoyed it.
We look forward to your next book. And I don't know, just thanks for being with us. It was really a terrific interview. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye, listeners, for now.